Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen. Today we're joined by a journalist, author, professional beach volleyball player, and rival podcast host, Travis Merwerder. Thanks for coming on Coach Your Brains Out.
Dude, thanks for having me. I'm on the other side of the hot seat. As you said, it's different being the one getting asked questions.
Yeah, it's my chance for payback. I got to come chat with you guys, and now we get to get into your brain. And in case people, some of our listeners don't know, you host the Sandcast. And I guess just to start out, what made you want to get into the world of podcasting other than the big money?
Aside from the millions that Tri and I have already banked, it was really Sandcast was all Tri's idea, just because we did the live stream, the color commentary for Manhattan 2 years ago when Tri was out with his autoimmune disease, and we had a ton of fun doing that, and he was really bored because he couldn't do anything, like couldn't even sweat or surf or obviously not play beach volleyball. And so he called me up and said that he wanted to, if I was interested in collaborating with him on a project, and he thought that a podcast would be a good idea. And I'd never done anything aside from writing. So, and I listened to a lot of podcasts, so I thought that would have been a lot of fun. And so we just kind of winged it. And I asked the editors at Volleyball Mag if they wanted to help kick us off the ground. And so they got us some equipment and we just started recording podcasts, and it was a ton of fun. And it helped me with what I was doing, because I was starting to write in the space of beach volleyball anyway. So, and having Tri as like an in to get to interview all of the top players in, not even just in the country, but in the world, it was perfect. And that's gone way better than either of us thought. Like, we just thought it was going to be a fun little hobby, and which it still is, but it ended up every stop we went to this year, people would just come up and like thank us for putting on the podcast. And like, I always felt bad accepting their gratitude, because I was like, well, I get to sit in here and just like pick the brains of all the best beach volleyball players in the world. Like, I'm the one who should be thanking them. So it was just this fun little project that Tri kind of kicked around, and we're now more than a year into it, still going.
Nice. And that's how like I first heard about you, Travis, was the writing you were doing on the qualifier at the time. It didn't seem like many people knew anything about the qualifier, or weren't covering it. Basically, we see video of the finals, and that's about it. But you were kind of documenting your journey and kind of what the other players were doing, and having brackets and kind of some speculation on who would qualify. And it was really cool, really interesting to see. And then to be able to follow your journey as you went through trying to make the main draw, and then had a breakout year this last year. I guess to start, can you just take us back to your first few years, like 2015, 16, maybe 17? What was your thought process when you were fighting in the qualifier? Was it fun, frustrating? Did you think about giving up? What was going on?
My very first qualifier, so was technically my first qualifier was an NVL in Panama City. And I had been living in this tiny little town in Florida called Navarre. And that's where I first picked up a beach volleyball and began to learn how to play. And so I was doing okay at the little like bar tournaments in Florida, because that's all we really had. And so my buddy Judd calls me and says, hey, I signed you up for this tournament in Panama City. We're going to go over and play. It's next Thursday. And so I was like, okay, sure. Like, that sounds great. Just a tournament in Panama City. And we go out, and lo and behold, it's a qualifier for a professional tournament. And I saw like people were hitting balls like way harder than I'd ever seen anybody. I'd never even seen anybody handset before. And everybody was handsetting. I was like, oh my God, like, what did we just get ourselves into? And we got pounded. I remember our first switch, we were down 7-0. And we ended up losing like 21-9, maybe 21-14. And I was like, God, I cannot let that happen again. I mean, which it's happened many times over since then. But that was kind of the first time that I was like, I really started to work at it, just because I hate losing so much, especially like that. First AVP qualifier, first like probably 2 years that I was in AVP qualifiers, I had no expectations of making it. I just wanted to win a set, which took a pretty good bit for me to do. I think the first set that I won was in Huntington of 2016. Me and Miles Magututia, who I'm playing with now, we played actually my pastor, Graham Cowgill. He had lived in the same town in Florida that I did, and he moved out to California just before I moved into Florida. So when I moved out to California, everybody's like, you got to see Graham speak. So I ended up going to his church, Mariners in Huntington Beach. And so he was my pastor for the 2 years that I'd been there, for the year I'd been living in California at the time. And then I draw him first round of the qualifier. And it was weird getting like pumped up to try to beat down your pastor. But I, you know, but I played him and Tom Kohler, and we ended up getting our first win in a qualifier. And like, I celebrated like I won the whole thing, because I knew that like our next round we were playing Ed Ratledge and Ty Loomis. So I knew that, like, I mean, Ed's been around forever, and I knew that Ty had won in 09 with Casey Patterson. So I knew that like we really didn't have much of a chance. So all I wanted to do was just win that one. And we ended up winning that one. And then I didn't even win another set in a qualifier, I think, the rest of the year. And then 2017 rolls around, pretty much the same thing. Like, I won a couple matches here and there, but that was it. So really, like, the expectations were just about making it one more round further. It wasn't necessarily to qualify. The only tournament before this past year that I looked at the draw and was like, you know what, I could probably actually do this, was Hermosa of 2017. I was playing with DR Vandermeer, who had a phenomenal year this year. Him and Troy Field took ninth in their first event in Austin. We were playing together, and we had what was a relatively good draw at the time. But with qualifiers, I mean, you guys know there's no really good draws, I don't think. I think it's just it's the biggest curse ever when the draw comes out and your friends text you that you have a good draw, because there's just no such thing. And we ended up losing in the third round to Logan Weber, who had a nice little year last year, and Charlie Van Reese. And that just like crushed me, because I was like, man, like that was my shot for this year. And then didn't qualify for Manhattan, and that was it for that year, because I didn't go to Chicago. Because at the time I was still writing for covering Pac-12 football, and I had to cover the opening weekend in Washington. So finished on losses, and then coming into Austin this year, I was playing with Rafi Paulus, and I knew that Rafi has gotten so many people into their first main draws. So when people found out that I was playing with Rafi, they're like, you don't want to be the one guy that Rafi couldn't get in. And we ended up making it in Austin. I had to play four matches. We were down 17-15 in the first set of our very first match. And so I was like freaking out. I was like, man, we came a long way to Austin just to lose in our first match. But then we ended up squeaking by, won the next one pretty easy, and had a barn burner against Matt Prosser and Eric Baranek. It was like an hour 20. Went to the third set, 16-14, got away with an egregious net call that they missed on match point. And then we got in Austin. And then the rest of the year, I was just kind of playing on house money, because I just wanted to qualify once. That was the whole goal. And then from there, obviously, the goals changed. Ended up making it in Hermosa and, you know, pushed it pretty far in Manhattan. We lost a tough one, 16-14, the third set, to Lev Prima and Jake Landell. Chicago, we lost in the final round, and then ended up making two more main draws in P1440 and snuck my way into a Norseco with Ben Vaught, and we kind of danced our way to a silver medal somehow. So the year has surpassed all expectations for me.
What keeps you going when you are I don't know, I guess when it seems maybe impossible, or when you're having those kind of tough qualifier losses, tournament after tournament?
Honestly, a lot of it is having written about so many players who are way better and way more accomplished than I am, that they've all gone through the same thing. Like, you can go through pretty much anybody's BVB. I mean, even Phil Dahlhauser, everyone has lost in qualifiers. And so everyone's gone through it. And the more I talked to and interviewed players and just like chatted with them in the players' tent, they're like, this is just the way it goes. He's like, you're going to lose, and you just got to figure out how to not lose like that again. So at least the next time you lose, you learn something from it. And it's just being able, like, the sense of community in beach volleyball is awesome. Like, everybody has been so willing to just help me out and give me advice. You two, especially, I think you two, Ed Ratledge, Avery Dross, Ty Trambley, like, you guys have been like instrumental in just being like, you know what, you lost. We've all lost in qualifiers. It's just, you just got to go to the next one. So it's really just kind of digging into that loss, figuring out what went wrong, and knowing that you can learn a lot from that loss. And if you just take one thing and make you 1% better, eventually over the couple of years, that 1% is going to add up to you. Hopefully don't have to qualify a whole lot anymore.
You're saying that you've learned from the losses. Can you take us through kind of some of the lessons you've learned? And maybe, for example, I know in Huntington this year you had a tough match to get in, and kind of what your takeaways from that situation.
Yeah, so Huntington this year, I was playing with Skylar McCoy, and we were up 12-10 in the third set. And then I shanked a pass. I doubled a ball. I was tooled off the block. And then we were down 13-12. And then I hit a line shot 2 inches out. And so we went up 12-10 to being down 14-12. And you just look at, and none of those mistakes were it would have been egregious if it happened in the first set and they weren't all in a row. But they happened in the third set, just four straight. And so I just looked at it and I was like, I'm never going to hit a line shot out. And so I just took that one thing, because I think lifts and doubles are going to happen if you hand set as much as I do. And there wasn't, I wasn't too mad about that, because it wasn't a bad decision to hand set the ball. Getting tooled on a block is something that's going to happen every night. I mean, even Phil and Jake and Andre and Evandro get tooled a lot too. So I could look at it and I turned too early. And that's why the ball ended up going 30 feet out of bounds off my hands instead of straight down for a block. So you just looked at what happened. And then, so the next practice, I hit hundreds of line shots, and in practice, I simulated where in my head I was down 13-12 every single time I passed a ball. Because that, the thing that got it all started was I shanked a path. So I was like, all right, well, we're just going to simulate that I'm down 13-12. I need to hit a line shot to make it 13-13. And I did that hundreds of times in a row. And then the next event I played was in Austin. And sure enough, when we were up 20-19 in the first set against Baranek and Prosser, I got served. I ran a back set and hit a high line. It hit the buckle. And we decided out for the win. And it's just, it was fun to see it translate immediately after practicing that. So it's just finding, I think if you take too many things from a loss and try to work on all of them, I don't think that that's the most effective way to get better, just because you're spreading yourself too thin. But if you pick out, say, three big takeaways, and that's Jeremy Casebeer and Gino Urango's big things, they look at three things you can take away from a loss, try to improve on them before the next event, and you do that for every event, then you're going to be able to improve kind of holistically across the board, but you're doing it in just three micro elements at once. And that's what I took away from Huntington. It's like, all right, well, I'm going to stay balanced on my block so I don't get tooled. I'm going to work on passing in pressure situations so I don't choke down the stretch again. And I'm going to make sure I don't hit a high line out of bounds. And that's ended up being the difference when we played Baranek and Prosser. And then we just hung on to survive in our next set. But it was just those three things that I took and was like, all right, well, we're not going to lose because of that again. And we did it.
And do you have three things after a win too, or is it only after you lose?
Oh, for sure. It's always easier to find the three things after a loss. But I mean, no, even if you play the best volleyball of your life, no win is perfect. You definitely could have done something better. You could have jump served better. You could have blocked better. You could have ran something better in transition. So I always look for three things after a win, after a loss. It's just easier to pinpoint them after a loss because they're a lot more glaring and obvious.
And so, yeah, you mentioned that next tournament you rode the Rafi train and qualified in Austin. How did it feel to, I guess, accomplish that goal you'd been pursuing for a few years?
It was kind of funny because I had built it up in my mind so much, it was awesome. Honestly, it was thrilling and exciting. And as much as anything, though, it was relieving that, because every tournament that you don't qualify when you haven't, that pressure just kind of builds and builds that, especially because I was writing about it and I had felt this pressure that, well, I don't want to just be this writer gimmick guy who's just writing about a sport that he can't actually play at the highest level. So I'd put that pressure on myself that I didn't want to be perceived that way, even though it's not, that shouldn't be a motivator, but it was. So when I qualified, it was as much relieving as it was exciting. And then two, I mean, the next day, like going in the players' tent was so cool to be there. But at the same time, too, it also kind of tore down this big mythology I had of being a main draw volleyball player. You know, when I first, you know, started playing in qualifiers, I saw, you know, I like marveled at just the way that guys would warm up. And I would think I would like kind of build them up as like these volleyball deities. And then when I was in the tent there, I was like, oh, I'm just like a really normal person.
Once you saw really Billy
sleeping on the couch.
Yeah. Like, wow. That's not that hard.
But it just kind of it grounded it in reality a little bit, which helped a lot, too, because then that took a lot of the pressure away. I was like, OK, well, I qualified and I'm no different than I was yesterday. And neither are any of the other guys. Like, they don't look at me any different. They just say congratulations. And like, everybody was super happy for me. Like, Billy, I still have your screenshot or the text that you sent me screenshotted that you said, heard you have an easy draw the next day. You should stay up writing about it.
Yeah, because we played you that morning, the next morning. Yeah, no, I think, like you said, you were being vulnerable and putting yourself out there by writing about it. So I think when you qualified, I don't know, like watching any good movie, we all felt like we had a piece of that, and can, you know, it felt bigger than just some other random team qualifying, because we got to be with you on the journey. So it was pretty cool. But I'm still glad we took you down that next day.
You definitely did. I was like, when we were up 11-10 at the technical, I was like, Raffy, we can do this. And then you went on a 6-1 switch both games.
John, how was it for you qualifying? Did it feel like, was there the mystique fade of being a pro player once you kind of were in the mix a lot?
Eventually, but not, I felt like the first time, I mean, I was still in college. It felt like, yeah, it was like Halloween or something. Like I was dressing up like a pro player for a day. It's like, whoa, there's Karch, there's Kevin Wong, there's, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess at some point, but definitely the first couple of times it felt very surreal. There wasn't Billy Allen in the player tent back then, you know, so kind of bring it back to earth. What about for you?
I think the first time Trambley and I qualified, I don't think they let him in the player tent. They thought he was, there's no way he was a player. And then yeah. I still like rarely use the massage table.
Oh, I never, the first 8 years I didn't.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I think we had a coach on, Rob Browning, who was talking about, that's one idea a lot of coaches have, is that these great coaches in the game, like if I could just sit in on their timeouts and just hear what they were telling their team. But he's saying like he's been with a lot of those coaches, and the reality is it's just what everybody else is saying. It's not like there's any profound thing about it, but we kind of build up a lot of this stuff. You know, what are those guys doing for warmups? They have bands. They must be doing some crazy stuff, you know, but it's,
I still do that too. And when I go out, I mean, when I go out and just pass balls with try, I like look at everything he does, like just in terms of like how he puts his hands together on a passing platform and how he does warmups. I'm still in that phase, and it's pretty funny too to see, because I practiced once with Phil and Nick, and so like that morning, like I was getting all jacked up and prepared and super ready. And then Phil and Nick were just messing around talking about video games and Fortnite, and Phil was kind of goofing off in practice. And I was like, okay, like these guys are just human beings too. Like they get to actually have fun when they practice. And it was funny to see that side of Phil and Nick, where they're just kind of playful and goofing around and making fun of Jason Lockhead.
So what do you think, what things do you credit your jump from that 2017 to 2018 where you started playing better and seeing some success? What did you do in that off season? What do you attribute that to?
I would definitely attribute that to changing the way that I trained. So when I moved out here, I was pretty much just playing games every day. And you don't, which is fine. And it's definitely a good way to get better, but I pretty much, not that I stopped playing games in practice altogether, but we would pass 100 balls before we would do anything. We would do triangle setting for like 20 minutes, and you would just get just so many reps back to back to back. And that pays off way faster than just playing games. Cause I remember I used to stat my practices to figure out what shots were working and what shots weren't. And Ben Vaught and I practiced against Avery Drost and Robbie Page. And I remember it was like 2 hours long, and I passed like 22 balls in 2 hours. And I told Ben, I was like, we're not going to get better if we're just playing matches for every practice. And so he agreed. So we usually like, I'll try to practice 4 to 5 times a week, but at least 3 of those are only with 3 people. And so we'll just warm up by doing 50 passes each and then 50 sets and then hitting like 20 shots. So you're right there. You've already passed 50 balls and hit 20 shots. So you've had 70 passes, and that takes like 45 minutes. And then after that, like if you play a match, you're probably going to end up passing close to 100 balls, and your reps are like times 5 of what they were. So I just started drilling a lot more and then paying a lot more attention to if something went wrong, why did it go wrong? So instead of like, even if I had a good pass, but it like was lucky and it hit like my bicep or like my wrist or something, I wouldn't be happy with it. I'd say, all right, well, can I get one more pass so then I can actually like pass it right? So it's just looking at why things would go wrong during practice and then just repping those out and just getting, you know, 50 to 100 extra reps per practice rather than just playing a match and having fun and going home.
So you've studied the both the qualifier draw and the main draw. Wondering what you think separates the high qualifier seeds, like a 5 seed or somewhere up there, versus a consistent main draw player. Do you think it's more a physical thing or a mental thing? What do you think it is?
Well, I think it's consistency for sure. And the comparison I would make is definitely, it's similar to golf, where, you know, anyone on the PGA Tour can birdie any hole at any time, but it's the guys who can consistently shoot 2 or 3 under par without taking like a triple bogey. And it's not all that different from beach volleyball in that most guys will be able to side out against Phil once in a row, right? But it's the guys who can string it together and not have a streak of 4 or 5 where you don't side out. It's just all consistency, which I think is as much mental, if not more than physical. Because like in the AVP, like if you make it into a main draw of a 16-team draw, you know, everyone can pass and everyone can set and everyone can side out, but it's the ones who can string it together to get to 21 faster than the other 2 teams. And from what, like, I'll use our example in Austin when we played Billy and Ryan, and that we were up 11-10 at the technical. And I'm sure that you and Ryan were not sweating in the least, Billy, because me and Rafi, like we couldn't side out consistently through an entire set to 21, just because you guys made the adjustments and like hitting it over Ryan's block, like with your defense back there, you have to hit almost a perfect line shot every time for it to go down. And that's something that I couldn't and still can't do consistently enough to beat you guys. So it's just consistency. Like I could hit a high line over Ryan once, but can I do it 15 times in a set? Probably not. And you look at like Phil and Nick, and even they'll make errors. They just don't make it on such a regular basis as, say, a qualifier or low-level main draw team.
And I guess, how do you work on consistency? Is it just the amount of hours you put in, or is there another way to, I guess, focus your practice to make that a focus?
Man, I would love to know the answer to that. If you guys have any help.
It's Billy's middle name. Billy Consistency Allen. Yeah.
Just be a... Don't be dynamic enough to get big eyes to try to hit the sharpest shot.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at guys like Christian Sorum, who I think he's one of the most consistent players in the world right now, and their success shows it in that he hits the same swing, the same 2 swings almost every time, every match. Like he'll start off hitting that hard angle 10 times in a row, and it's going to go down. And because the defender has to move so far over it, it opens up that line swing, which he hits tremendously too. So I think that if you ask Christian how he practices, he's going to hit those 2 swings all the time. Like if you just have your 2 strikeout pitches that will move the defense in such a wide direction. Like, I don't know. If you look at – that's the one that I can point to, is that Christian just – he hits those 2 spots that he hits so well. And he doesn't need all these crazy other shots and like jumbo pokes. And like you look at like Adrian Carambola had every shot in the book because he needed to. But Christian doesn't. He just has these 2 really, really good swings. And that led them to being one of the best teams in the world, along with Anders also blocking about 10 balls a match.
Yeah, he helps.
Yeah, and I would also say that when I think of an inconsistent player, sometimes I picture somebody that's afraid to get blocked or dug. And so they're trying to go too extreme away from the defense, where, I mean, I think Karch towards the end got Doug a ton, but he never gave you any free points. And he would, you know, he'd be good enough to dig you back if you did dig him. And so I think when you're just part of the consistency is just, you're not giving up these free points. Cause even if like you do dig me, like you still have to earn the point another way. You're not just, you know, hitting it out of bounds. I think being afraid to get blocked or dug, you see people kind of get erratic.
That's the problem with so many options. Like you were saying, if you just have one or two options and you're not going to hit out too much, hit your one shot.
Mesco, just cut shot or high line.
So you had mentioned how your expectations have changed. Initially, it was just try to win a set in a qualifier, and now it's shifting. So what are they going into next season?
I mean, I think – so there was probably a difference between expectations and goals. I think the goal would be to qualify for all of them. Expectations probably whittle it down a little bit just because, say, I missed the first one. Well, then I'd be super depressed because I already missed out my goal for the whole season. So I think my expectation going into every tournament is that I do qualify or at least make it to the final round. But that, you know, I know that I love talking to you guys about this stuff because we both know that like the results are somewhat out of your control. You can only control like how you play and what exactly you do. So if I'm getting served, then the only thing I can reasonably expect of myself is to pass the ball. And then after that, is to just side out the set. So it's really just one thing at a time. But in terms of result-based expectations, the expectations I'll have going into qualifiers is to actually make it, whereas this year it was a really pleasant surprise. But I think I'm kind of past that where I wouldn't be so much – I think I'd be more surprised if I didn't give it a good deep run in the qualifier than if I did, which is – it's kind of a cool feeling because we ended the season – Miles and I ended the season – P1440 Huntington, and our expectations were just to break pool, and we ended up taking fifth in a tournament that like was pretty top heavy and also kind of deep. Like Ed Ratledge and Rafa were in our pool and didn't even make it out, which is crazy. It's nice to kind of have lower expectations because once you hit them, then you're just playing on house money. I think expectations qualify for making a couple single digit finishes on MVP.
Can you talk about expectations? I know Hermosa was kind of a different tournament for you, and maybe you had higher expectations. You wrote about it in your blog. Can you kind of take us through how that one was different and how maybe it actually hurt you, or it seemed like a tougher loss, even though you guys, you know, beat a main draw team?
Hermosa, yeah. So what I really liked, I mean, I was almost piggybacking on what you wrote after. You know, you made the finals. It was your best tournament of the year. You were just riding this high, and then you had this really difficult loss in the finals. And even though it was your best finish of the year, you still left feeling kind of disappointed in how it went. And that's – I would mirror that sentiment for sure. Like, Hagen and I made it through the qualifier where, I mean, honestly, we almost had no business qualifying. We kept finding ourselves down 10-8 in the third set, and somehow just Hagen just willed us back to a win. But yeah, we had this huge win over the McKibbins in the first round, winning another match that we really had no business winning, really only because Madison just kind of had a fluke, like temper tantrum and punted a ball in the first set and kind of red carded us to a win. So we get that win, it's a super fun match, and then end up making Saturday. And we had already surpassed expectations, and I shouldn't have really like demanded a whole lot more, but I was like, well, we're playing Troy and Chase. I've played against these guys so many times in practice. They're a new team. Like, they haven't figured it out yet. Both of them are still pretty young. So it's not like we're playing two like really savvy veterans who have been here before. Like, this is a relatively new position for both of them. And their first time being there as a team, and then I crumbled the whole first set. I mean, they served me every single ball, and you lose 21-9. Like, everyone knows whose fault it was. And then the second set, like, we lost 21-17, play a little bit better, but it's still like I don't think that we made one defensive play. And we were just out of control the entire match. And I left feeling just – it was so disappointing because I let myself kind of see how much further we could have gone had I not played so bad. Because I was like, well, if we win this, we'd have a match against Tim Baumgren and Kane Schalk, who are also a new team who haven't been able to practice together. So I kind of started looking ahead. So even though we had this really good finish and I'd never made a Saturday on an AVP, I'd only qualified once before. So I was already playing on kind of house money and surpassed what I'd expected of myself. But expectations can change mid-tournament, as you know, Billy. And when you fall short of your new expectations, you leave and you're like, man, what a disappointing tournament, even though it was at that point the best tournament of my career. So that one kind of stung, but it does serve as good motivation, and it does kind of give you that reality check and a little dose of humble pie that I think all of us need from time to time after having a better finish than we've ever had, and then unreasonably expecting more once we get there.
Yeah, it's a good lesson. It's crazy how it can shift, like you said, even in one tournament or game to game. What are you working on this offseason?
This offseason is still, I think that you can never go wrong with passing. I mean, I've gotten served with every partner I've ever played with. So if I still need to dial in the passing, that's the big one. Working on that hard angle swing that Christian Sorum loves. I watch so much volleyball YouTube, and I love picking out the players who can do one thing like exceptionally well. And I think Christian Sorum and Taylor Crabb hit that wrist away so well. And I hadn't really had that. My favorite swing was always the line turn. So I'm trying to add that. And I added it in Huntington for P1440, and it worked out really well. And Miles, he even mentioned a few times, he was like, wow, like that worked. Cause we worked on it like all week in practice leading up to it. So those are two of the biggies. And then it's weird. I finally have like a set partner heading into the season. So Miles and I are going to play together domestically. He can't play internationally because he's kind of stuck in a bind with the American Samoa Federation. But so I actually get to train with a partner for 4 or 5 months before a tournament, which is new for me. My BBB list of partners is like embarrassingly long. So we're going to work on just some team stuff. We both like running plays just because both of us are pretty good hand setters, and Miles likes running out and running shoots and quicks and kind of the fake shoot stuff that you're seeing the Polish guys run. It's a ton of fun to do. So we're working on running our own little offense.
Cool. And are you going to keep writing about your journey?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the fun part for me. I mean, writing is just what I've done since fifth grade. I love writing, can't get enough of it. And so yeah, I'll keep writing. Hopefully keep writing some more books. You know, just trying to keep up with this Billy Allen guy who's got a blog of his own and a book of his own.
He's everywhere. All right. So you often ask this question on your show, so we're going to flip it and see what wisdom you have to offer. So what advice do you have for newer players trying to break in?
I think for newer players trying to break in, the biggest thing I would say is be curious about, one, the game. You know, if you're not looking into, you know, who's been great and why they were great and who's great now and why they're great, and looking into your own game, like, what am I doing wrong? What can I improve to reach that next level? I think that one of the biggest things for me is just digging into film. And that starts with a curiosity about why things went well, why things didn't go well. And then having the curiosity to ask you guys, what do you guys see in my game? Like, how can I improve? Like, I just shanked 30 balls that got served to my line. What did I do wrong? And the access to professional beach volleyball players at the highest level is unlike any other sport. You can't just pluck LeBron James off the side of the street and say, hey, like, can you help me with my 3-point shooting? But you can do that with beach volleyball for the most part. I mean, you guys are always willing to help and listen to this podcast. Like, I get so much help from this podcast and just listening to you guys. And all of this stems just from a curiosity about the game and how you can get better and just the different ways. And because, like, there are so many different ways you can get better with the same exact skill. Just find what works for you. But it starts with just being curious and trying all these different things.
And now that John's not competing anymore, he can finally give you all his secrets. He was holding back.
Exactly. And he's lefty too, so it's perfect.
There's no secrets, just hard work.
So yeah, you did release a book and stole all my sales. Can you tell us what your book is about?
Hey, well, I did give you one sale. I do have your book sitting in my room here somewhere, buried with the rest of my books that I just got for Christmas. But my book is is just kind of it's a walk through the 2016 AVP season, and each stop details a couple players' various backstories and how they got into beach volleyball and how in the world they got so good at it. Because guys, like, there's no traditional path into beach volleyball. I mean, even there's no real traditional path to indoor volleyball, just because there are so few colleges that have programs and so few high schools before there are colleges. So beach volleyball, like, the stories of players had always fascinated me. And so that's the first thing that I started working on when I came out here, is just asking players, like, how did you get into it? And there are so many interesting ones. You know, you look at, like, Ryan Daugherty, who you guys have both played with and was a baseball pitcher, you know, came back and was living on a couch in South Carolina for a little bit. It's like, oh, beach volleyball, that sounds about right. And he couldn't even beat, like, high school girls in South Carolina, moved out to California, lost a couple grand playing blackjack in Vegas on the way, ended up being the world's largest pizza boy, and now he's making a push, like, one of our best international players. And I just loved looking into stories like that. So the book just details as many of the players' stories as I can in a structure that I tried my best to keep reasonable and chronological. But it was that was definitely my biggest struggle, was the structure. So Billy, when you texted me and said that you kind of liked it, I was like, yes, I got one.
Yeah, I thought it was cool that you kind of, you know, throw those flashbacks in, and, you know, it's structured around that one season, but then you tie in so much. Yeah, and I mean, I'm really glad that you're around and you're writing. There's not enough stories told about beach volleyball. There's plenty of fantasy stories, but not enough about beach volleyball. So appreciate what you're doing. And then also with the Sandcast listeners, if you have to listen to one podcast, listen to ours. But you know,
if you do two,
I guess you can do the Sandcast.
Yeah. Got room for two. We'll be number two.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thanks for coming on, Travis.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate it. And, hopefully we'll have you guys back on Sandcaster soon enough.
Yeah, if you get desperate enough.
Yeah. Yeah, get Billy next. You guys can talk fantasy books.
Done. I'm in.